Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa Aparuta de sangamatasa tavara ye sodavanta bamunjantu sadang.
So this is the Magga Puja, full moon of February. So I'll read this and tell you what, for those who don't know, what Magga Puja Day is. The Magga Puja Day is the annual celebration of the Buddhists hold on the full moon day of the third lunar month, which is February, in the Buddhist countries. In Thailand, the ceremony of Magga Puja is performed to emphasize the significance of the Magga month. It was the period in which the Buddha constituted the main code of his instructions and which is universally regarded as the heart of Buddhist teachings. Historical events preceding this period must be reviewed briefly. So it says, the Buddha delivered his first discourse to the five ascetics, namely Anyakondanya, Vapa, Bhadiya, Mahanama, and Asaji, who when they heard the Enlightened One were ordained becoming the five noble disciples. The Buddha then made a retreat at Isipatana in the deer park near Benares, and there he ordained Yasa, the son of an influential family, who had approached the Buddha and had received instructions on the discourse concerning the fivefold principles, namely generosity, morality, happy life, renunciation, and benefit of ordination. He took as his refuge the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Thus he entered into the monastic life, and the order now increased to 60 in number. The Buddha urged the monks to journey in different directions and places to disseminate the law of the truth. Hence the first Buddhist mission began. The teaching of the Awakened One has since spread to many people in many lands. The Buddha himself went to preach at Rajagaha, the capital of Magadha state, and there these three ascetics regarded as great teachers became Buddha's monks, together with their disciples, the reported number being 1,000. Bimbisara, the king of that state, became a Buddhist, taking the triple jam as his spiritual guide and supporting the Buddha's mission. The king gave as a residence for the Buddha and his order a quiet and suitable place called Veluwana Vihara, the bamboo grove. And this was the first Buddhist temple. Here many thousands of the citizens became Buddhists. During the period when the Buddha was staying in Veluwana Vihara, a certain incident took place on the full moon day of the third lunar month. The bhikkhus, about 1,250 in number, who had been ordained by the Buddha himself and since then engaged in missionary activities, returned without prior notice to the great teacher to question him further about his teachings. Thus took place the great assembly of all the holy ones of Veluwana Vihara, where Buddha delivered the discourse on the main code of his teaching, which can be summarized thus. So this is the summarization of the Ovada Patimokkha. Patience, that is to say forbearance, is considered the supreme endeavor. All the Buddhas speak of Nibbana as the highest goal. A Buddha, a bhikkhu who still does harm and violence to others is not a recluse at all. Do no evil, do whatever is good, purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. Non-abuse, harmlessness, restraint through the disciplinary code. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. So it's quite, when you think of it as 2,545 years ago, and so this is taking place this evening, this sense of celebration and reflection on this historical event. Well, it gives a strong sense of lineage in this monastic form, that it has its roots way back in the past. For most of us, 2,545 years is an enormous amount of time. And we wonder what was happening here at Amaravati 2,545 years ago. Probably wasn't even called Hertfordshire then. Or England. So history is like memory, isn't it? We remember. Things seem to hold in the memory. So we do inherit memories from the past. But then the purpose of all this is to be fully present. So this do good, refrain from doing evil. This is advice of how to live in the human realm. This idea of harmlessness in not intentionally doing evil or abusing or harming other creatures is something that of course, is like the way of living in the world, living on this planet, in this body, so that our relationship to the conditioned realm is not one of exploitation or violence or abuse. So that, of course, those kind of mental states, when we act on violent feelings or abuse or harm, that creates such a strong memory those kind of memories are very hard to transcend. The more violent, abusive, harmful acts that we do, of course these are what we remember. And just in your own experience, when you think of the not very skillful acts or things that you've said in the past, or heedless acts, or even evil, deliberate, intentional evil acts done, these are, when we meditate, they still arise in our consciousness. So, in terms of living in the human form on this planet, the advice is to do good, to do what is kind and generous, helpful, considerate, and refraining from acts and physical action and speech that causes division, causes harm to oneself and to others. You know, like Buddhist monasticism is very much this whole sense of harmlessness, the idea of bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, keeping precepts is to really commit oneself to a way of living at this time in which we make a strong commitment to harmlessness and nonviolence. And to say the morality of this taking responsibility to live in a way that we don't create a lot of regret and guilt and remorse in our lives. Celibacy, for example, is, I look back all these years, 36 years of celibacy, is the result is of quite a very peaceful mind, because being celibate, one thing is not indulging in the excitement of sexual activities. So, and those are strong memories. One's sexual activities, one tends to remember very easily, and tend to stimulate or excite the consciousness. So, so much of the modern present day films, you can see these films on international flights and very explicit sex scenes, and they are very exciting, actually. And then and violence is blockbuster films, even committed to nonviolence. I still find blockbuster films still very exciting and entertaining, where all about war and violence. So it's recognizing that the realm we're living in is a realm where we can act, we can commit violent acts, and we can live, seek excitement in endless pursuit of sexual pleasure or violent actions. And I know some people that do that, it's not an uncommon thing to do. So then, say, monasticism is our commitment to making a strong commitment to refrain from intently seeking those kind of activities. And then what is the result? The point is, it's not some kind of moralistic judgment and puritanical approach that we're teaching, but reflect on the results of your life, how you're living your life here as a samana. Purify the mind. And this, of course, is what meditation is about, when we're the various meditation techniques and anapanasati and satipatthana, and all these are around, you can call it a kind of purification. It's interesting, just the subject of consciousness, how this, the consciousness is what we're all experiencing right now. This is a common, this is the bonding experience that we all have at this moment. That which we're all experiencing right at this very moment is consciousness. So just reflecting on that, the consciousness is about the formed realm. In this realm with forms, with creatures, with conditions in it, that we experience consciousness through form. So when we contemplate the four elements, the earth, fire, water, and air, and then you add two more, space and consciousness, so that is the kind of totality of experience in terms of an individual human being. Now, in terms of the physical condition of the human body, and the material world that we live in is this combinations of these various four elements combined with space and consciousness. So we can, as we contemplate the four elements, say just in one's own body, you know, practices of reflecting on the earth, fire, water, and air as they exist in terms of the physical body that we experience at this present moment. The way of looking at the body that is not looking at it as a, through a personal, identity. Or through identifying with it, as belonging to oneself. There is usually, you'd say there is this, the earth element, the solid element, the liquid element, the heat element, the air element. Space, or sometimes call it ether, isn't it? We are experiencing space now. Space and consciousness. And these, of course, space and consciousness have no boundary. They're infinite. So consciousness then is what we're using in meditation. We're using consciousness to contemplate the way things are. So that's why I keep pointing to rather where we get very confused because we consciousness is something we can't really get hold of in the way that we can see earth, fire, water, and air, or conditions of the mind, emotions, the vedana or the sanya sankara, and that these are because we're conscious, we can actually be aware of thoughts or emotions or the body as it exists, as it manifests in this present moment. Sometimes we think of consciousness as in a very limited way, just through the eyes, the ears, in terms of sensory consciousness, because then consciousness is very much limited to perceiving through the senses. But when we begin to recognize, realize consciousness non-attached to the senses, that's what I point to when I refer to this sound of silence. So this is like that when you begin to recognize or notice that, then that there is consciousness unattached. It's consciousness, but it as you sustain awareness with that sound of silence, then you can reflect. You begin to get perspective on your thoughts, emotions, feelings, sense activities, sense experiences that arise in consciousness in the present. So the importance of recognizing, realizing the this is something really wonderful that we can do. You know, the whole point of the Samana life really is aimed at this kind of realization. Of course, the obstructions come with our commitment to the delusions that we create. And of course that, the strong sense of a self, a separate self, identity with the body has been a strong sense of oneself, or emotional habits, thoughts and feelings. And so we create ourselves into consciousness, so we have this kind of personality that we tend to identify with, and let it constantly kind of push us around. So this encouragement to rest, to relax into this awareness, say with awareness, this sense of awakening, attention, then the consciousness, as we begin to recognize the sound of silence, from this point, if you sustain attention, just rest in this state of open receptivity, not attached to the ideas of it. Like some of you attach the idea of getting the sound of silence and attaining something with it, or making, you know, you keep creating some false illusions around it. That's not it. We're not trying to make anything out of it, but to be able to fully open to this present moment in a way that is unattached, non-attachment. And of course, this recognition of unattachment, of non-attachment, is something you know through through awareness rather than through description. All I can say is, don't attach to anything or let go of everything, things like this. But then people attach and say, we shouldn't be attached to anything. And they attach the idea of non-attachment, because we're so committed to thinking and trying to figure everything out. We want to figure it out, know it all, in terms of the idea of it, the theory of it, the technique, the party line, the Theravadan approach, and on like this. We become very bound and bind ourselves to the conditions, even though the teaching is about letting go or non-attachment. So this is where the encouragement, this retreat, to see, really observe attachment. You know, trust yourself in this awareness. Not an attack even on attachment, holding to a view we shouldn't be attached, but recognizing attachments like this. So in the early days, I used to really practice attaching to things quite intentionally, just so I know what attachment is like, rather than having some idea I shouldn't be attached to anything, and then in some desperate way, always trying to be detached or non-attached, and only ended up fooling myself, because the basic delusion was never penetrated. You'll think, I'm somebody who's attached and I shouldn't be. That's an attachment, isn't it? I am this monk who has all these attachments, these hang-ups, and they're obstructions, and I shouldn't be attached to them. I've got to get rid of them, let go of them. And the attachment to that is you end up fooling yourself and endlessly kind of disappointing yourself, because you can't do it that way. It doesn't work. So this is why I emphasize this pure state of consciousness. Now, just take it for granted, you know, don't try to figure out whether, you know, think about it very much. You know, don't try to theorize or figure or spend a lot of time analyzing it. Learn to just do it, you know, contact this resonating sound or vibration. Just learning to stay with it just for the count of five, or practice so that you get used to it. They begin to appreciate this. And it gives you, if you really cultivate it, it gives you this space where you're beginning to recognize or be conscious without being attached. So that the conditions that arise in consciousness can be seen in the perspective of arising, ceasing. Also, pure consciousness, when we let go and just abide in pure consciousness, unattached, then that's also the experience of love, unconditioned love. Because pure consciousness accepts everything. You know, it's not a divisive function. It doesn't have preferences of any sort. It accepts everything, every condition for what it is. The bad, the good, the demons, anything. You know, so when you begin to trust in it, then the metta bhavana really becomes alive, because it's not just spreading good thoughts about and altruistic ideas, but it's actually very practical and very real. But in terms of love, what do we mean by this? You know, because it's a word that can be used in so many different ways. And of course, to many people, love is the ultimate attachment. You know, when you love somebody, you want to possess them. Become very possessive, and oftentimes what passes for love in the modern consciousness is a very strong attachment to another person or something or some creature. But in terms of if you really want to apply this word to that which except, like in saying metta, loving kindness, is love that is unattached. It is not attached. It's not preferring. It accepts everything. Everything belongs. And so, when you begin to trust in this awareness, in this conscious moment, that is infinite, then everything belongs in it, you know. And then from this perspective of this particular being here, then whatever arises in this consciousness, whether it's from through the senses, from outside as they impinge on consciousness, or from inside, from the emotional conditions or the physical conditions that become conscious in this present moment, then this sense of love, acceptance, non-judgment, it accepts everything that you're thinking, feeling, experiencing. It allows everything to be what it is. And it's not trying to, when we don't allow things to be what they are, then we always are trying to get something we don't have or get rid of something we have that we don't want. So then the desire realm begins to take us over. We begin attached to desire and we endlessly struggle, fight, contend, resist, hold on, and that is the realm of dukkha, the dukkha that we create out of ignorance. So in terms of purifying the mind, then this it's really, consciousness is pure, so you don't need to purify it. You don't have to do anything. So you begin to disidentify, not hold to the views, the conventional views of yourself as being this person, this way, this condition, this body. It begins to drop away. Doesn't compute anymore. Doesn't make any, not the way things really are. in terms of meditation, you know, as you trust in the awareness, then certain things come out into consciousness. Some of them are, you know, worries, resentments, self-consciousness, memories of various kinds, all kinds of bright ideas or whatever. Then our relationship to them is accepting, embracing, allowing. Then in terms of action and speech, the good we act on, or we can act on, and the bad, the evil we don't. But we accept both. Non-critical. So that is to me what love is. It's non-critical. And so that applies both to what arises in my consciousness, say just my own karma, the memories, the kind of emotions, feelings and that arise in the moment. And behind it all is this sound of silence. You know, it's like this enormous, vast, infinite space that allows things to be what they are, because everything belongs. The conditions, of course, their natures to arise and cease. It's the way it is. So we don't demand that they be otherwise. You know, we're not trying to ask the impossible or complain because we'd like to hold on to the good stuff and completely annihilate the bad. So in this way, you know, when we recognize, then our true nature then is pure. You know, when we begin to realize and fully trust and appreciate this is real. This is not something I create or imagine. Not theoretical, abstract, not an idea. It's reality. Consciousness is very real. It's not something you create in a dream or through some theory you have about consciousness, isn't it? This is consciousness right now. Anyone here not conscious? So that's very, you know, that's a fact. That's just the way it is. Then the conditions that we might be experiencing, you know, can be all different. One person can be happy, the other sad, the other bored, confused, fired, depressed, worrying about the future, regretting the past, and all like this. So who knows all the various conditions that are going on in all of us at this moment. You know, only you know what's going on in your particular experience now. Whatever it is, you know, good or bad, or you like it or don't, want it or don't want it, it's the way it is. So then you begin to really, your relationship to it now is through this purity of being, rather than identity with the conditions, which you can never purify the conditions. You can't make yourself a pure person or, you know, a personality that's absolutely pure. It's an impossibility. You know, it's just, that's not where purity is. when you try to purify yourself as a person, it's a hopeless task. Like trying to polish a brick, isn't it? Make it into a mirror. It's trying to, demanding the impossible. And of course, you're only going to fail and be terribly disappointed if you're trying to seek purity through purifying yourself as a person. So this is where this awakening, isn't it? Awakened. That's the original purity. In other words, you've always been pure. You've never, ever, for one moment, been impure. You can't. Now, even if you're a serial killer, if you're, the worst demon in the universe, you're still pure. The purity is impossible to destroy. So the problem lies not in losing or, becoming impure, but our attachment to the delusions that we create in our minds. Like a demon, it's so attached to being a demon that it forgets the original purity that's present here and now. So, if you're strongly identified with being a demon, then you tend to act like that. You do and say demonic things. So we can become, we ordain as monks and nuns. So then we attach to being monks and nuns. So we act like monks and nuns. We're just acting the role and identifying with the conditions, then we become, these kind of boring people, kind of self-righteous and think they're purer than other people and things like this. So you get into monkishness. So we can do it too. We can grasp the conditions and become monks and nuns accordingly. But that's not the purpose, is it? The convention is not pointing to itself as an end in itself. It's a skillful means. It's an expedient means. So on this Manka Puja day, this emphasis on Owada Patimokkha, patience, that is to say forbearance, is considered the supreme endeavor. And of course this is, this was my practice the first few years in living with Lungpa Cha. Patience. And that was not an easy practice for me because I was, I'm very, impulsive, impatient as a person. So, forbearance, learning to endure, to bear with what I don't like and don't want. So this was, Lungpa Cha said, in the beginning, he said, "Tomato, your practice here is patience." and it certainly put it on a very practical level of really learning to just bear with things. It's very frustrating when when you can't understand the language and you're in a very, you have all these limitations placed on behavior that you've never had before. that brings up so much angst, rebelliousness, frustration, irritation. So all those stories that most of you have read, you know, about not wanting to wash the teacher's feet and thinking wearing a sankati on Bindabat is just a bunch of rubbish and all the opinions I had, you know. Actually, by developing patience, not just sitting and kind of gritting your teeth, but there was always reflection going on. You know, was I just, you know, trying to prove something to myself that I can take this life? You know, I want to be a commando and I've got to prove myself, you know, to be a forest monk and you know, prove I've got what it takes. So I'm going to, you know, or there was a certain amount of that, you know, but there's also reflection, you know, of observing how much suffering I'd create. You know, just like observing that going out and helping to wash Lungpa Cha's feet, really, that wasn't suffering. That was, when I really got into it, I quite liked doing it. It was a lovely thing to do. But before, when I was thinking, I'm not going to do that, 20 monks washing one man's feet is stupid. I'm not going to be stupid like they are. And you're here stewing in this awful kind of fulminating with bitterness and anger and criticism. I create that. I'm making that. I create that. That's what I create. I can't blame that on anybody. So that began to separate what I've been asked to do and my own resentment and rebelliousness. That's the suffering I create. And to know the difference, you know, like in the monastic life, both in Thailand and here in England, the way we hold it, you know, the suffering we create around it. Begin to notice, you know, but allowing your suffering to be conscious, you know, so that we're not trying to, you've got to say, you've got to just put up with it and you've got to be patient and grasp the idea of patience and forbearance and hold to the view that we should be patient and forbear. But this is a suggestion to the mind, you know, learning to stay with something, to get past. To be able to stay with something till you see what actually you're doing with it. What's actually, you know, how you hold it, what you expect and demand, or what you don't like, or what you assume from the convention you're in. So if you don't have patience, then you'll never see that. You just, you know, when the inspiration's gone, you start with inspiration usually. I want to be a monk. Just sit and meditate and reach nirvana and be not harmless and non-violent, celibate. Free myself from the defilement. And not have to get caught in that mess out there. All that confusion. Silliness of modern life, and so that you feel, oh, this inspiring life. And then the inspiration drops, you know, because they can't sustain inspiration. Especially because it's usually based on delusion. so then you don't like it anymore. You see, you start looking around. I used to look at the monks that I lived with in Wat Bapong. That monk, you know, look how many pansas, how many vasas he's got. Look at him when he eats. Monk, they used to, in the rainy season, everything mildews and turns moldy.
the smell of some of those monks is terrible. How could you possibly be, anybody doing anything if you smell so badly? And then the cultural gap, how easy it is to misinterpret everything. We've got an American cultural conditioning, it's so easy to get it all wrong in Thailand. So you mistake everything, you make assumptions, you create endless problems because you don't understand. You're judging it from an American mindset. Same here, when I first came to England, judging the British through an American mindset, I got it all wrong. And if you're patient, you begin to see through these things. So patience then is the supreme endeavor. Because this realm is basically, it's nature's restlessness. Everything's changing. You're constantly being irritated in the human form. Since the time you were born till the time you die, this is a relentless experience of irritation. Just contemplate, every day how irritating, how much irritation there is in every moment. Things just impinging. And it's too windy today. And then that's irritating, isn't it? It hits you. You feel it irritates the senses. If too many people come, or too many children on a Sunday scream and run around the salads, and those are quite obvious irritations. But just the irritation of having eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body, and then a mind with memories in it, with attachments, views, and opinions, how we irritate consciousness endlessly. This irritation it makes us very restless. This is like the wind. It's like a restless experience. So patience is learning to begin to recognize, begin to really appreciate the stillness. You begin to know the still point. Then you can bear the irritation. You can forbear, you can accept, you can allow the wind to be the way it is, the emotions you're having to be the way they are, the fears, desires, greed, hatred, and delusion, the body, the way other people are. We can allow them all, we can allow all conditioned phenomena to be the way it is, because we're no longer just caught in resisting and attaching and trying to, get hold of the good stuff and get rid of the bad stuff. Because when we do that, we just increase the irritation. We endlessly irritate the irritations. That's why it's the dukkha or the suffering. The more you resist and control, the more suffering you create. So that's a reflection for this evening. And then the formal retreat will begin on the 11th of March, 11th to the 24th. Formal, go back to community formal retreats. And again, my appreciation to the lay support group. I only hear very good things about you all. And the food is absolutely fantastic. Would you like to stay on after the retreat? You don't have to ordain or anything. So at 10 o'clock we can meet here and we'll have a celebration for the Manga Puja, circumambulating in the cloister. So we can all meet here again at about 10 o'clock.